For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So, you know how most stories start out with a really bad problem? You ever notice that pattern? Can anybody here think of a story, like a really good story, that begins with a bad problem? Anybody? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, what else? Give me one more. Shawshank Redemption. Yeah, I mean, seriously, the problem is the hook. That's what makes you interested. You know, if you find out that there's an evil empire with a Death Star that they want to use, that's a problem. If there's a wizard who wants the One Ring to rule them all, that's something you have to deal with. And that's how the Bible opens. You know, the Bible isn't fiction. It's our story. It's history. And it opens up with a huge problem. And the problem is Adam and Eve, the first humans, disobeyed their creator. They disobeyed God. Now, I don't know where these like different books get Garden of Eden pictures from. I don't remember like a monkey in the Garden of Eden, and that looks like a velociraptor. Most people are familiar with the basic story. There was a tree that God told Adam and Eve, don't eat from the fruit of this particular tree. Then they met the serpent, Satan, and Satan enticed them to go ahead and eat the fruit anyhow. And they did. And that set in motion a cascading series of events that is it's a big train wreck. It's a huge problem. Their disobedience resulted in alienation from self. So you had people that were created perfect in a perfect environment, but now they can just tell there's something profoundly broken. That's why their instinctive response after they sinned was to try to cover themselves up. You know how that sense of discomfort that we feel when we know we're not what we ought to be, that we're not what we could be, that we've sinned, that sense of guilt, it leads to a sense of self-alienation, not just for them, but for us today. It led to alienation from others. The second this happened, you start to see Adam and Eve finger-pointing and blaming each other. And you see a rift in their relationship that spills over into a broader conflict. We see people murdering each other as the Bible unfolds, nations going to war. Human history is filled with conflict and alienation. And it all goes back to this one act of disobedience. This, we can trace the taproot all the way back to what Adam and Eve did. In addition to that, and this is probably the biggest thing, is there's alienation from God. You know, in the original setup, it says at the end of chapter 2 that Adam and Eve were naked and not ashamed. They were completely comfortable with themselves, completely comfortable in the presence of God. It was a picture of total intimacy and the possibility of deep union that Adam and Eve had with God. And again, when they sinned, that fractured their relationship with God and everything changed. That's why when you read in chapter 3, after they eat that fruit, they're hiding out. They're avoiding the presence of God. And so these things, all of this is the problem that the Bible sets up with. And it's this last one, alienation from God, that is our primary issue. This is humanity's dilemma. You know, in some belief systems, like pantheists, the human dilemma is that we fail to recognize that we're not part of all that is, that we fail to recognize that this is all kind of an illusion. For a lot of belief systems, Hinduism, Buddhism, that's the problem. You don't realize that this whole world is an illusion. In other belief systems, like in animism, our problem is we need to appease unpredictable evil spirits and kind of get on their good side so that they don't harass us. But in the Bible, it's this. In the Bible and all the religions that come from it, the core human dilemma is alienation from God. Another way to put this is true moral guilt. This is the idea that we have done things that go against God, done things to hurt each other, and that we are morally culpable before a good God for what we've done. So that's where the Bible starts. And what we're going to spend this whole morning on is how God responds to this problem. So that's what we're going to dive into. Now, if you're familiar with the Bible story, you know that he didn't just zap us. We're here. I guess that's evidence that he didn't wipe us out for rebelling against him. He didn't ignore the problem either. What we see in God's response is really two things. We see a series of confrontations where God talks to all three guilty parties that were part of that original conversation where Satan enticed Adam and Eve to sin. So there's a series of confrontations in his response, and then he reveals, kind of woven into these confrontations, God reveals his plan to rescue humanity. Okay, so that's what we're going to get into. Let's talk about the confrontations first. There's three, obviously, Adam, Eve, and Satan. I guess I'm going to go out of order. Just to remind you, this is what happened to Adam and Eve after they sinned. Something like this. That's God with like a posse of cherubim. If you read in Genesis 3, he confronts Adam. He comes to Adam and says, "Did you eat the fruit I told you not to eat?" And what does Adam do? He blames Eve. And what does Eve do? Follow her hand down. She blames the serpent. Okay, so there's a series of finger pointing that flows out of God busting them for what they did. But God isn't fazed by that, and just he systematically confronts each of these parties. And so let's start out with Adam. All right. To Adam, God says, "Because you've listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying you shall not eat from it, cursed is the ground because of you, and toil you'll eat of it all the days of your life, both thorns and thistles it'll grow for you, and you'll eat the plants of the field by the sweat of your face. You'll eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for your dust, and to dust you shall return." Now remember, when Adam and Eve did this, they were told, if you eat from this fruit, you'll die. This fruit will kill you. And so now God's reminding Adam of that. When Adam and Eve ate that fruit, they didn't die right away. They died spiritually. Physical death would come later. And God tells them it's coming. You're going to go back to the dust that I made you from. So physical death, that's one of the things that God confronts Adam with. The other thing he brings up, that we're not going to get into all the details, but he mentions that work is going to be different. Work will never be the same now that sin has entered the world. A lot of us, we just see work as intrinsically evil. It's just a pain. It's a necessary evil, something I've got to do. That's not the Bible's view. In the Bible, God did work, and he called it good. God gave us the good work, Adam and Eve the good work of cultivating the garden. So work is dignity. Work is a good thing. Work is still a good thing, but work is tainted and poisoned by the introduction of sin into the world. He describes it as thorns and thistles, toil, not just work, but labor and toil. It's going to be more difficult. For us, broken copiers and attending meetings that have no agenda. Nobody knows why they're there. Whatever it is, work doesn't work the way it's supposed to anymore because of sin. That's one of the things that comes out of what Adam and Eve did. To the woman, he says, I'll greatly multiply your pain in childbirth, and pain you'll bring forth children, yet your desire will be for your husband, and he'll rule over you. Okay, so here, God tells Eve, look, you're gonna have kids. That's a huge blessing, but it's going to be painful. This is going to be really difficult for you to go through. And he mentions that her husband will rule over her, that this is another one of the consequences of sin. Now, let me be clear. This isn't God prescribing what should happen. between Adam and Eve. This is God predicting what will happen between men and women, between husbands and wives, now that sin has entered into the world. So these are some of the things that God laid out to Eve. And then, and this is what I want to spend most of my time on, God confronts Satan. It says, the Lord said to the serpent, because you've done this, cursed are you more than all cattle and more than every beast of the field. On your belly you will go, and dust you'll eat all the days of your life. And I'll put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He will bruise you on the head, and you will bruise him on the heel. Now, if you read this in the New American Standard, you'll see there's a footnote next to the word bruise. It can be translated, and I think should be translated, crush. The same word is used when it says bruise you on the heel. That's also crush you on the heel. So what a weird cryptic thing for God to say. What we're going to find, though, is especially verse 15. It's one of the most important verses in the entire Bible. There's a lot there. We're going to spend a big chunk of time looking at this. But one thing that's evident right away from what God says to Satan is that God is going to utterly defeat him. That's what this imagery, on your belly you will go, dust you will eat. Well, snakes don't eat dust. God's not talking about literally eating dust. These are metaphors for humiliating your opponent and defeating them. This is Psalm 72, verse 9. There's other places in the Bible that use similar language. It says, let the nomads of the desert bow before him and his enemies lick the dust. What this passage is communicating, the clearest thing that comes out from this, is God is going to utterly defeat Satan. And not just for a little bit, right? All the days of his life. That's why I say utterly. He's going to completely wipe him out. This will be a permanent state of defeat for Satan. So there you go. Those are the confrontations. But what about this murky verse, verse 15? What is going on? Well, I'm going to argue that woven through this confrontation to Satan, God is giving us a peek into his plan to undo the damage caused by our sin. And see what you think. God's rescue plan is all there in verse 15. A while back, there was a woman who fell into a dam, like the spillway of a dam in Iowa. I don't know if you guys saw this on the news. A construction worker working in a nearby project and his crew rigged up a crane, swung over this construction worker into the spillway, and lifted this lady to safety. Now, I don't know if you've seen the Lowhead dams up and down the Olentangy River or the Scioto Dam, but if you get caught in one of those things, very difficult, almost impossible, especially a big spillway like this, you can't get out without outside help. And that's the situation the Bible opens up with, is our dilemma, our true moral guilt, it's beyond remedy as far as we're concerned. There's nothing that we can do to fix it. Fig leaves aren't going to cover it, right? Adam and Eve couldn't fix their true moral guilt on their own. There's no way. They were utterly helpless in this state of alienation from God. And so what we read is God's, he knows that. And so he comes up with a plan, and he lays out his plan to redeem people, to restore his relationship with people in a series of three stages or enmities. Conflicts. So there's stages to this plan, and it centers around these conflicts that come up in verse 15. I know that seems strange, but let's just kind of walk through it. Let's talk about the first conflict. The first conflict is between the serpent and Eve. God says, I'm going to put enmity or conflict, hostility between you, the serpent, and the woman. All right, now for years, this is so pathetic. A lot of people have read this verse and decided the Bible predicts that from this point on, women are going to hate snakes. But that's what this means, which is totally preposterous. Some women love snakes, and some men hate snakes, right? Another ancient movie reference there. Yeah, that's ridiculous. This isn't about a snake and all women. This is about two individuals, Eve and Satan. That's who he's talking about. That's the focus. Now, what's the nature of the conflict? Well, imagine being Eve, realizing, just starting to see these consequences spinning out. We can tell from the early chapters of Genesis that after Eve became aware of good and evil, one thing she quickly discerned was that Satan was evil. You know, she trusted him enough to eat this forbidden fruit, but afterwards she didn't trust him. Instead, she totally and fully aligned herself with God. That's what you see in the early chapters of Genesis. Now, there's several ways to support this, but probably the clearest is in Genesis 4. Now, just to jog your memory, Adam and Eve had two kids. They had Cain and Abel. Abel followed God, but Cain didn't. In fact, Cain killed Abel. And so in this passage in Genesis 4:25, Eve is celebrating the fact that she has a new son, Seth, to replace Abel. And listen to what she says. It says, Adam had marital relations with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son. She named him Seth, saying, God has given me another child in place of Abel because Cain killed him. So right there, who is she crediting for the birth of Seth? Not Satan. She's crediting God. She's grateful to God. And look what it says. It says, so a son was born to Seth, who was named Enosh. And at that time, people began to worship the Lord. Okay, and so what we see here is Eve is excited that God has given her a child who's a God follower, a child whose descendants will continue to follow God. And so what we start to see in this conflict between the serpent and Eve is there's this rupture, not just between the serpent and Eve, but between humanity. We've got some humans like Eve, like Seth, like her descendants, like Seth's descendants. And then you've got other humans like Cain and his descendants that are not following God. So there's this big rupture. So we've got conflict, not just between Eve and Satan, but a wider conflict, which is what this second conflict is about. It's between the serpent's seed and Eve's seed. Okay, the passage says there's going to be enmity or conflict between your seed and her seed. Now, if you look at this, the your seed, Satan's seed, that sounds like the title of a really bad horror movie. Satan's seed, what in the world is he talking about here? It's not talking about Satan's literal offspring. It's talking about that branch of humanity that decides to continue pursuing their rebellion against God. As the story of the Bible unfolds, that's who he's talking about. A big chunk of humanity, like Satan, continues in their rebellion. Her seed, though, is the community of humans who choose to follow God. And you start to see, not just in Genesis, but developing all the way through, there really is, this is how God sees humanity, either for him or against him. Even when you get into Genesis 4 and 5, this is a huge theme, these two humanities. You've got Adam and Eve who have Cain. Cain was a murderer. Cain had these descendants. If you read about them, they're not very good people. Lamech goes ahead and he writes a song about killing people. So this Cain's line is continuing Satan's rebellion against God. If you study the line of Seth, like I mentioned earlier, these guys are notable for the fact that they did follow God. Enoch walked with God, and then God took him because he liked him so much. So you've got these two different aspects of humanity, both different opinions about God, and this is a repeated theme all the way through the Bible. I could show you lots of examples. I'll just show you one. Let's go all the way up to the New Testament. This isn't just back then. These humanities still exist today. Paul says, you used to live in sin just like the rest of the world, obeying the devil, the commander of the powers of the unseen world. He's the spirit at work in the hearts of those who refuse to obey God. All of us used to live that way. But God is so rich in mercy, and he loved us so much that even though we were dead because of our sins, he gave us life when he raised Christ from the dead. Now, this passage says that when we're born into a race of rebels. We're born into people who, like Cain, like Satan, have rebelled against God. But it doesn't have to stay that way. We can actually choose between being dead, like Adam and Eve were after they rebelled against God, or having life. That's, you know, when we think about distinctions in our culture today, what do we think about? We think about what your political view is, or what race you are, or what your social class is. Those are the key distinctions that divide our society. But from God's perspective, there are only two camps in humanity. People who are alive spiritually and in right relationship with him, and people who aren't. Read the Gospels. Jesus is very strident and very clear about this. He says, if you're not with me, you're against me. And that, I think just to a modern ear, I know that sounds really offensive, but I wouldn't be doing the Bible justice unless I said it just that clearly. Now, let me make sure I qualify here. The idea that there's two camps, those who have God's life and those who don't, that doesn't mean we should, like, mount some kind of holy war. That's been done, and it's really bad. I've seen that happen over the centuries. God and the Bible utterly reject Christians ever trying to impose their will by force on anybody else. A holy war is completely contrary to what the Bible teaches. Read later in the same chapter, and he talks about bringing the gospel of peace and giving people the free choice to decide whether they'll be part of this humanity that has life or not. But make no mistake, there are two camps, and every human has to decide which camp they want to be in. These are the only two options. Fortunately, like this passage says, you can have life. We don't have to remain spiritually dead. We don't have to stay alienated from God. We don't have to cope with the weight of guilt for what we've done on our own. There's a way that we can have life. And remember, that's the thing that Adam and Eve really lost, isn't it? In the garden, what happened? God banished them. They lost access to God's life. This says we can have it back. How do we have it back? Well, that involves this third conflict that we need to look into here. Conflict number three is between he and you in this passage. Now we're zeroing in on two specific people. The pronoun in Hebrew in this last part of Genesis 3:15, it's a singular personal pronoun, male pronoun. He, it says, will crush you on the head, and you will crush him on the heel. Interesting. The he here is definitely a descendant of Eve, a male descendant of Eve. That's crystal clear from the context. And this you, like we've seen all the way through, this is about Satan. So this is a conflict between a future male descendant of Eve and Satan himself. A conflict that's at the very heart of God's plan to rescue us from the dilemma of sin. Now, how does this play out? Well, if you follow this individual that he mentions in Genesis 3, he actually is given a nickname in the Bible. His nickname is the seed. And we see the seed repeatedly mentioned. And every time the seed is mentioned, God is zeroing in on his identity, giving us more specifics about who he is. First, we find out he's a son of Abraham. God tells Abraham, one of your descendants will bless the entire world. Then we're told he's a descendant of Abraham's son Isaac, of Isaac's son Jacob, of Jacob's son Judah. So he's from the Jewish tribe of Judah, whoever this guy is. Later on in the Bible, in a couple different places, we're told this person is a son of David. And by this period, around 1000 BC, there's a title for this person. Not just the seed, the anointed one, or maybe a title you've heard before, the Messiah. And this isn't just a Christian interpretation. You can look at several very ancient, highly regarded Jewish commentaries on the Old Testament that say that the he in Genesis 3:15 is this Messiah, a son of Eve, a son of Abraham, a son of Isaac, a son of Judah, a son of David, an individual that will come and conquer evil and set up God's kingdom. That's who this individual in Genesis 3:15 is, that is going to go into a battle with Satan. Now, how on earth does that involve his defeat? This weird business here about bruising, right, or crushing. He'll crush you on the head. This male descendant of Eve, the Messiah, will crush you on the head, and you shall crush him on the heel. What is this all about? Well, this, like we've said already, like we saw in verse 14, this is about how the Messiah, that's who the he is, he'll utterly defeat Satan. He'll crush him. It's like a video game headshot or whatever. You know, a blow to the head is a fatal blow. But what's interesting about this is this Messiah, as he defeats Satan, will be wounded himself in the process. You'll crush him in the head, but he'll crush you in the heel. What a weird thing to say. And I'm going to argue that this is the first place in the Bible that we get a hint that God's solution to our problem is the Messiah, and that for it to work, the Messiah must suffer. And I'm going to walk you through, and I'm going to be really careful to pace myself here. But don't geek out on the details. Just absorb this. I'm going to show you how all through the Old Testament, with a lot of imagery and symbolism, God repeatedly says this messianic figure is going to have to suffer greatly in order to provide a solution for sin, in order to defeat Satan. Okay, so the first image that we've just talked about is this idea of a bruised heel, that there's some kind of wound that the Messiah is going to undergo. This is the first of many images that show how he'll suffer to overcome sin. Going further on, even just in chapter 3, we read that when Adam and Eve sinned and tried to cover themselves with fig leaves, God wouldn't have it. He was like, take those off. And he made them wear garments of skin, animal skins, for his wife. He clothed Adam and his wife, and he clothed them. So think about the imagery. What is an animal skin? You have to kill an animal, right? And then God said, I'm killing these animals, and I'm going to put them on you in order to make you presentable to God. And as the Bible unfolds, this idea that someone's going to have to die in your place, there's going to have to be a death as a covering of for sin, completely unfolds and develops. Read Genesis 4 and Genesis 8. Abel offers an animal sacrifice. He takes the life of an animal as a substitute. Then we read about Noah in order to avoid the flood ever happening again. Noah offers sacrifices to God. And God sees these animal sacrifices and promises, I'll never judge the world through a flood again. So the notion that I'd have to take the life of an animal and have that be some kind of a covering to make me presentable to God, an animal sacrifice. This is a repeated theme that keeps developing in the Old Testament. If you go to Genesis 22, there's a very grisly, disturbing story where God asks Abraham to take his son Isaac and sacrifice him. And it never happens. God doesn't let Isaac do it. But Abraham goes up to this mountain puts his son on an altar, and right before he's about to sacrifice his son, God intervenes and says, "Abraham, Abraham, withhold your hand from your son." And he tells him, "Stand down," basically. "Don't do it. Don't go through with this." But think about that picture. And it even uses this language. Abraham sacrificing his son, his only son, in this specific place in the world. It's a crazy story. It's a disturbing story. And at the end of the story, we read this. This weird commentary. There's a picture of Abraham and Isaac up there. At the end of that bizarre drama with Abraham and Isaac, Abraham calls the name of the place, the name of the mountain where he almost sacrificed Isaac, "The Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord, it will be provided." So we read about this amazing drama and we realize it's not just the drama, it's pointing to some future sacrifice, some future offering that's going to happen on a specific place that just happens to be right smack dab in the middle of Jerusalem if you study it more. Now, if you go further on, you've got the imagery of Exodus. In chapter 12, God says the angel of death is going to sweep through and take the firstborn children of the Egyptians. And he tells Jewish families, if you want to escape my judgment, you have to do this. You have to kill a lamb and take its blood and spatter it across the lintel and the doorposts of the entryway to your house. And if the angel of death comes and sees that, he will pass over that house and they won't be judged. You see the idea? There's already a repeated theme. There has to be a death. Through sacrifice, through these animal skins, through this blood over the door frame of the house. There has to be a death to deal with sin. And then we get to Leviticus 16. This is a famous day, one day a year, called the Day of Atonement. And during the Day of Atonement, the Jews would take a lamb and slaughter it and take its blood and go into a special room inside their tabernacle called the Holy of Holies, and they would approach a very special gold-covered box. You've probably seen it before. That's the Ark of the Covenant from Raiders of the Lost Ark. And no joke, this is what was happening. You can read about this in Leviticus 16. This box contained evidence of the sin of the people. And those angels, it says in the Bible that they look down on the lid of this box, which is called the mercy seat. And the priest is supposed to go in and take the blood of this lamb and sprinkle it over that lid. Now you tell me, what's the imagery? It's a covering, right? As God's witnesses, the angels see a covering of blood over the people's sin. So this is a very repeated theme, this idea that there's going to have to be a wound to be a solution. Do you see the imagery? Sort of. You see what I'm saying? Do you see the constant emphasis on death as a covering for sin? It's over and over again. And all of this comes into focus as we roll through the rest of the Old Testament in a description of a final, ultimate sacrifice for sin. The sacrifice of a human being, God's Messiah, his only son, on our behalf. This is exactly what it teaches in Isaiah 53. It talks about this messianic figure who was pierced for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we're healed. All of us like sheep, it says, have gone astray. Each of us has turned his own way, but the Lord caused the iniquity, the sin of all of us to fall on him. My servant will justify the many as he will bear their iniquities. The language is very clear. A human being will be sacrificed. His life will be given because we've gone astray. And what he does will justify us. He'll bear our sin. It's all there. All that imagery leads up to this idea that the Messiah himself will be the sacrifice that all these other images point to. A human offering his own life in the place of us. A God-man, the Messiah who dies for us. And I realize as we look at a lot of these images that they're offensive. I don't say that lightly. People, it's really true, killing animals and spattering their blood, making a father go through this horrific scene, nearly sacrificing his own son. You know, what in the world? You know, you read the Bible, you're like, this is so primitive. I can't believe this stuff is in here. And it is. It's offensive. There's no doubt. But it's there for a reason. It's meant to communicate the horrible cost of dealing with true moral guilt. You know, God is a just God, and God is a God of law. And when we violate his law, the sentence is death. It's perfection or nothing. And death is costly. And that's part of what we're supposed to get, that this is going to be painful. That there really will be a wound that the Messiah has to sustain. Now, if you've been tracking and follow, if you're still with me, then this should have new significance for you. When John the Baptist was with a group of people, he saw Jesus coming toward him. And when he saw Jesus, this is what he said: "Behold, the Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world." This wasn't some idle comment, and it wasn't some thing that John made up, the idea that the Messiah has to suffer and die. This was, in many images and symbols for centuries, foreshadowed. And now John was watching the Messiah show up to carry out that part of God's rescue plan. You know, when we think about the cross, when you look at an image like that, it's hard to look at. You know, I thought about zooming in a little bit, but I don't think I need to do that to make the point. You know, the Bible talks about the offense of the cross. Crosses, it is grisly. It's a human offering his life for us. And yet, that is completely consistent with all these images that describe what the Messiah would go through. Listen to Francis Schaeffer. I agree with every single word of this quote. He says, "Man can't stand before God in his own covering. Rather, he needed a covering from God, a covering of a specific nature, a covering that required sacrifice and death. A covering not provided by man, but by God. It's my opinion that this was the beginning of the Old Testament sacrificial system, looking forward to the coming of the one who would crush Satan's head." He's talking about those original animal skins. Back in Genesis 3:15, he's saying they foreshadowed our need for a covering. They foreshadowed the sacrificial system. They looked forward to the coming of the one who would crush Satan's head. And he concludes, "The death of Christ was not an afterthought in history." That's right. God's plan was laid out very clearly all the way back then. I think that's pretty amazing. And I want to conclude with just a couple thoughts here. You know, it is true. You can make this case. From the moment Adam and Eve sinned, God was launching his rescue plan to bring them back to himself. From the very moment, right after it happened. And he does it like we've seen. He foreshadows that plan in a lot of different ways. All these images, all these symbols. And not just here and there, but repeatedly for centuries. And not just one author, but all these different authors from all different places and different times, separated by tons and tons of years, all presenting a very coherent and compelling picture of what the Messiah would finally come and do to make our salvation possible, what he would do to defeat Satan. I'll tell you, you study the other scriptures, look at other belief systems, you'll find nothing like this. This is unique to the Bible. This is one reason why I'm up here teaching. This is a reason why I'm a Christian, is because this is incredible. So that is all incredible. Here, though, for me, the most stunning thing is as you think about just how grisly and difficult all of these pictures were, I think what's even more stunning is that he went through with it. If you read in Genesis, right as God is watching Abraham get ready to sacrifice Isaac, right at that moment, God steps in and says, "Don't do it! Stop!" But when Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane and he asked God, is there another way? The answer was no, there's not. Nobody intervened. This time, the Son did it. He went all the way to the cross, voluntarily, offered his life for us. And so, I mean, it's not just, wow, that's compelling imagery, that's great evidence for Christianity. It blows my mind that God went all the way with this. And he did it for us. I think it's important to, as part of why those images, as hard as they are to look at, that's part of why we have to look. So that's God's response. You know, he sees the dilemma. He sees you rotating in the spillway, struggling to get out. And his response is to go to the cross for you. That's what it is. So what about you? What's your response to this going to be? There's a lot of different ways we could respond. One I would hope would be to look into this, to really look into what I'm talking about and be persuaded for yourself that this kind of foreshadowing is there. Another would be to consider this thought. It's another quote from Schaeffer. It says, in the flow of history, there are two humanities. The one humanity says there is no God, or it makes its own gods in its own imagination, or it tries to come to God in its own way. The other humanity comes to the true God in God's way, and he says there's no neutral ground. And so, you know, one way we can respond to this is to come to terms with our culpability and to tell God we want to be part of the humanity that's following him. Not the humanity that's perfect and sinless. John says if any Christian says they have no sin, they're a liar. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about humanity that's acknowledged their need for God and come to him in his way. Look at how he puts it in Isaiah. This is a great verse on this. Isaiah, he says, I'll rejoice greatly in the Lord. My soul will exult in my God, for he's clothed me with garments of salvation, and he's wrapped me with a robe of righteousness. See, we need that coat, that animal skin, as much as Adam and Eve did. We've always needed it. We've always needed the covering of death for our sin. But we have to choose to put that on. We have to choose to let go of the ways we self-validate. You know, a lot of times we try to separate ourselves or feel right about ourselves by religious observances, by being nice, by, you know, being generous, by making smart purchases on Amazon, whatever it is we do to feel good about ourselves. And that's all the fig leaf approach. That doesn't acknowledge you're in a spillway, rolling around in desperation. What we have to have is God's provision, the humility to accept his covering, to accept the significance of what he did. And all you do for that is just to reach out and ask for it. Tell God, I want your son's death and his blood. I want that as a covering for what I've done. And he will respond and receive you, just like he received Eve back when she turned to him. All right. I think that's all I'm going to say about that. Now, we got a little bit of time. Maybe we can talk briefly. I realize we haven't said much of the so what for Christians. So this is, you've been a Christian for a while, and how are you supposed to really continue to lean on what God has provided? You think about questions like this. These would be diagnostic questions. Am I withdrawing from relating people? Do I hide my flaws? Is it hard for me to handle criticism? Are you, in an ongoing way, benefiting from this clothing God has given you? Yeah, God, I thank you for what Tom said about still struggling with you. It's true. Ah, man, I can totally relate to that comment. I pray over time, especially as we look back at what you've done here, that our trust in you would grow and that we'd learn to go your way willingly and because we're fully persuaded that it's the way for us, God. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.